This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is the Thursday before Christmas, which means that all of next week I am on vacation because my major client shuts down for an entire week at Christmas. So we're going to be tooling around doing stuff next week on vacation. It's going to be great. I think we may make a couple of quick runs down to Branson here or there. And, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. We are staying in town because this will be my dad's first Christmas without my mom around, and this will be my wife's mom's first Christmas without her husband around, because we lost both Papa, which is was my father-in-law, and my mom this last year. So, you know, we're at that stage of life. So we thought we'd stay in town and just kind of hang around, planning on going over to my dad's house through the Christmas holidays and maybe cleaning out some stuff over at his house and getting some things under control there. My daughter and son-in-law, they're heading up north, taking the grandkids with them, so they're going to be gone for a little bit. But next week, maybe next Thursday, maybe next Saturday, I think we're all going to see the Star Wars movie, the new Star Wars movie. So we will do our standard podcast for that. After we go see the Star Wars movie, then we'll all pile back in the car and then talk about the movie. Probably would be good for me to see it once before then, but we'll see if that works out. It's always nice to see it ahead of time, see it once, have time to kind of mull on it a little bit, and then see it again and kind of confirm the reactions. But we'll see. So we're going to take the whole gang. At least that's the plan. Net and I and Liz and Alan and Clara and Asher and Ember. So we're all going to go next week. It's been a good week. Been plowing along, getting some things done. Everybody's brains were starting to downshift because it was the week before the Christmas break. So, you know, their brain starts working that way. I saw one of my coworkers in the hall, and so I said, Merry Christmas to her as I went by, and she said, yeah, that's the problem. She said, I'm already in Christmas mode. She said, but I'm still here. So, yeah. But they just have one more day, obviously, because they work on Fridays. And then they're going to be off for a week as well. So this is nice. This is good because my client being closed, nobody calls me. Although, this time we will have some workers in. Next week. We normally don't, but there's a bunch of things that have kind of all come together. For one thing, next week will run through the end of the month, and so they won't be doing any work before the end of the month if they didn't go in. So they're going to go in for a couple of days. And then in addition to that, the 15th, which is usually when they target for being closed for the year, the 15th happens to be a banking holiday this time. Martin Luther King, I think, day. And so because of that, they really need to get the missionaries paid before that. So they're going to back time it in, and they're actually working a couple of days next week. But that just means the IT people have to be on standby, which that's fine. No problems. We've got our cell phones. And we can remote in. Isn't technology grand? So that's all going well. The writing is going fine. I've had just several little things crop up here this week. I was supposed to be done by my read-through by now, but, you know, it'll be fine. I'll get some good reading in tomorrow, and probably finish up on Saturday and then get working on the files, and then hopefully by Sunday I'll be squared away. And then we'll see. I don't know if I'm going to order as many review copies as I normally do, because I don't think I will need them. Because book seven is not people's favorite book. But it was an important book for me to write. And I feel like I had some important things to say in it. And I was glad I said them, even though I knew it was going to be pretty rough for some of my readers, because it's about gender relationships. It's about sex. Which, the interesting thing is that I have been shown again, from an experiential example viewpoint, no one has said, after reading the book, oh, I don't agree with you in terms of gender relationships, in terms of lust and fear, in terms of exploitation, both from the feminine side and the masculine side, in terms of all those things. No one has said, no, we don't agree with that. What has been said is, no, we didn't enjoy the book. No, we didn't like reading about that. No, we didn't. And I think this simply exemplifies some of the difficulties in these topics. We don't want to talk about matters of reproduction. We don't want to talk about matters of gender relationships. You know, we don't want to talk about sex. But in the process of not talking about those things, we actually create for ourselves an environment of failure. And I find it fascinating because I grew up in a culture where they talked about it quite freely. It was no big deal. They were very practical. And so definitely your culture is going to impact that. But then by the same token, I think there is some flesh at work in that as well, because not talking about it creates an environment of failure. And I covered that in the book as well, that there are things that we need to be prepared for. And our lack of preparation is to our detriment. But, you know, it doesn't matter. People don't want to talk about it. So, it's fine. But I really try not to blink. You know, I am going to talk about this stuff. And if people don't like it, that's fine. What's interesting is I've been thinking the last couple of days, this first set of books, you know, was really kind of dealing with physical discomfort, topics that were of physical discomfort. I think the next 8 set of books are going to be dealing with some topics in addition to physical discomfort, mental discomfort. How do we know what we know? How do we deal with doubt? And then the final set of books is not only going to be dealing with physical and mental discomfort, but it's also going to be dealing with spiritual discomfort. What is the true sign of success in our lives? What has Christ called us to in terms of the tenor of our lives? Has he truly called us to be comfortable, to convenience, to control, to certainty? And obviously the answer to that is no, but we don't like that answer. So I pretty much don't expect to have any beta readers by the time I'm done with this, but that's okay. I will have said the things I felt I needed to say, and if I only have one beta reader at the end of all this, and that beta reader gains something from these books, it will be worth doing, because I gain from the books. So I may end up being my own beta reader. Although my daughter has said she'll stick with me till the end. So that's good. I have one. So we'll see how this goes. It's all very fascinating. It's just very, very fascinating. Anyways, so that's that. This week, came across an article last week, I think, that I thought, oh, that's a very interesting article. And then the more I kind of researched it, it wasn't quite as interesting it sounded like to begin with, because there were some assumptions that were made in some of the underlying claims, but that's okay. You know, I've got two different articles about this. I do think this is interesting simply from a perspective of how there are unexpected requirements, unexpected necessities, unexpected consequences of technologies. And specifically, these articles are about Bitcoin mining and energy consumption. Now, for those of you, for the two or three of you who actually listen to this podcast, I'm assuming you know what Bitcoin is and what's going on there. But let's just quick. Okay, Bitcoin is what's called a cryptocurrency. It is not issued by any sovereign government. It exists as a measure of value outside of all those things. Bitcoins are created through mining operations that are really nothing more than solving math problems. And then the results are all encrypted into something called the blockchain. And then people can be, the bitcoins inside that blockchain can then be traded and moved around and bought and sold, etc., etc., etc. The blockchain then becomes the repository of bitcoins that are mined through executing on computer hardware these very difficult computations. The Bitcoin blockchain also hold who owns what Bitcoins and what transactions have occurred with these Bitcoins being bought and sold. Okay, so in case you don't know, Bitcoin has gone crazy this year. Bitcoin started out the year at being worth about $1,000 a Bitcoin, and it has, I don't know if it's crested 20,000 yet. I think it has crested $20,000. It's back down around $16,000-$17,000 a Bitcoin. So it's had this huge run up. And of course, this makes other people very interested in mining. So there's a lot of people that are doing mining. And specifically within the last month, 2 months, there's been a surge of Bitcoin mining because it's just like the price of gold. When the price of gold goes up, then maybe it makes sense to go out and do more prospecting. So that's what it is. It's prospecting. And it does have some chance involved, just like prospecting. So, you have all these Bitcoin miners, and they have all this hardware that's dedicated to this. I heard one estimate from someone who supposedly knows, and they were saying, if I remember the figures correctly, that Google, all of its hardware, all of its hardware equates to 1 teraflop. So I think that's 1 trillion floating point tera. Maybe it's quadrillion. I don't know. It's some big, huge number. The number of floating point operations per second that its combined hardware can do. So that's a big, big number. That's Google, who has servers all over the world. They say that the Bitcoin mining hardware now constitutes 540 teraflops. The hardware that is dedicated to mining Bitcoins and managing the blockchain for Bitcoin is 540 times the hardware that allows Google to do what Google does. Okay, so anybody who tells you that Bitcoin is just a flash in the pan, that Bitcoin is nothing, that Bitcoin is just vaporware, doesn't understand the amount of hardware and effort that is going into Bitcoin at this point. And one of the indicators of that is the energy usage. And that's specifically what these articles were about, because there was some estimates that came out in an article that was trying to extrapolate the numbers, and they made a claim that the Bitcoin mining was on track to consume all of the world's energy by 2020. Now, that's a, you know, that is an incendiary claim, and it's probably not true. But the fact is, I'm sure all of this hardware does consume enormous amounts of energy. Hard to track exactly how much, because you have so many different people running hardware. But it's very interesting. You know, according to some of the estimates, it's the combined energy consumption is somewhere around 33 terawatts of electricity annually, which is like on par with Denmark. I mean, it's just crazy. It's crazy, crazy stuff. One moment, I'm getting my mail. And, you know, so some people are saying, oh, what does this do to global warming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you know, that's pretty interesting that, oh, somebody sent me a package. Shirley Gilmore. Don't know what that is. Oh, and more packages. More packages. Oh, I know what that is. Okay. So anyways, it's all very interesting, and there's no question that it is consuming a lot of electricity, and the more that Bitcoin's price stays where it is, the more energy consumption you are going to have, because it makes sense to go after this stuff if it's paying out at $16,000, $17,000, $19,000, $20,000 a Bitcoin. So yeah, this is going to be really interesting. So, they were estimating that the Bitcoin network's energy consumption has increased by 25% in the last month alone. Now, whether that's sustainable, who knows? Certainly, once the mining is done, I'm backing into my garage, and the mining is going to be done. I think at present estimates, all the Bitcoins are going to be mined by 2020. Once that mining is done, then the energy consumption is going to go down, but you have to get there first. And I just, there's some really interesting thoughts when it comes to Bitcoin, because the question is, are we going to get energy constrained? Are we going to get energy constrained before all the Bitcoins can be mined? And what will that do to the scarcity of the Bitcoins? And what will that do to the price? I mean, it's all really, really interesting. Also at this point, cyber criminals are infecting websites so that they can compromise that hardware and get that hardware to mine Bitcoins for them, so they don't have to pay for the energy. And they're saying that some of the websites include Showtime and the torrenting site, the Pirate Bay. That these people have been found that they have these software on there. They've got a quote in here that they're saying, right now it's not millions, but this money has been made in 3 weeks at almost zero costs. So they're estimating that a joint profit is somewhere around $43,000 that have been made from people compromising other people's servers to mine Bitcoins. Yeah. So there you go. You know, that some clips from, or some quotes from the other article, global energy production obviously can't double in 2 years. and it would be an environmental disaster if it did. Fortunately, while the Bitcoin network consumes a ridiculous amount of energy, particularly on a transaction basis, the situation isn't as dire as some of the critics claim. So they talk about the fact that it should drop. But it's still very, very significant, and it will have an impact. They said in another spot in the article, under Bitcoin's current design, will the energy network's consumption to continue to rise over the long run? Under Bitcoin's current design, this depends entirely on what happens to the price of Bitcoin. If Bitcoin's price doubles to 25,000, we can expect the Bitcoin network's energy consumption roughly to double as well. If Bitcoin's price falls significantly, on the other hand, miners will find their operations unprofitable and will start to switch off their least efficient equipment, causing energy use to decline. Right now, the company that put out this estimate estimates that Bitcoin is consuming less than 1% as much energy as the U.S. economy. This means that for Bitcoin's energy consumption to exceed that of the United States, Bitcoin's price would have to rise roughly 100-fold to more than $1 million. Could this happen before 2020? Doesn't seem likely. Of course, in early 2015, Bitcoin was only $200, and hardly anyone expected a 50-fold increase over the last 2 years, but here we are. Interesting stuff. It is just really interesting stuff. There's several options of how things could be put in place to help change this, but you know what? One of them is for Bitcoin's price to decline. It might. Another way would be to shrink some internal things as to how much Bitcoins are paying out, and so you could slow things down by doing that, and then that would mean it would be less profitable. People would pull off the network. You know, and a third way would be to change the mining process altogether. But of course, the people who have made these huge investments aren't going to want to vote for doing that. So they concluded the article by saying, you know, all of this means that Bitcoin's energy consumption isn't going to go down anytime soon. So it's just very fascinating. It's very fascinating to watch all this stuff in play. And there's such effort behind it. After I was reading all this stuff, you know, I really thought, you know, this is interesting. I mean, I think I already told the story about my experience with Bitcoin years ago when Bitcoin was trading in the 75 to 250 range and I was playing with it. And no, I don't have any Bitcoins right now, much to my chagrin. But at one time, I did have 10 Bitcoins, and I'd made back almost all of my initial investment. That's a whole other story. I think I've told that story. Anyways, you know, sometimes I lose track. I just lose track. I mean, you know, this is episode 456. But at one time, I did have 10 Bitcoins. And, you know, when you see that they're trading at $19,000 a pop now, I'm thinking, that could have been $190,000. But, you know, hey, life goes on. And God's been good, so it's okay. But anyways, wrap it up, Phil. Wrap it up. It's really interesting to watch all of this. And so I've started to just kind of nibble back into the market. I'm just investing, you know, $100 here, $100 there. Just with a exchange called Coinbase that it seems to be a much stabler exchange and seems to have better backing. It's U.S. based, et cetera, et cetera. I was with Mt. Gox, and Mt. Gox went down in a bankruptcy thing and I lost everything. So that's a whole other story. But anyways, I am just kind of dabbling at this point. And at this point, you know, I've doubled the amount of money I've put in. Granted, it's not much money. I've put in $700, but the last time I checked, you know, I'm over $1,400 in like 2 weeks. And I'm going to keep dabbling a little bit. I do not recommend it for anyone else because you've got to be able to lose the money. It's just when you're talking about cryptocurrency, no one really knows yet what is happening. But it's fascinating. It's really fascinating. And it definitely is going to be one of these things that is going to have a major major influence on what the world looks like coming up in the future. And it's going to be one of those things that, maybe if Jesus tarries and the devil don't hinder and the crick don't rise and we're still around in the next 50, 60 years, when people look back on cryptocurrencies and the blockchain technology, they will say that was one of those fundamental things that caused the shift towards the future. And that's going to be really interesting to watch what happens with it. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.